It seems dangerous. I see well enough, the girl replied. Not so much with my eyes as with my other senses. Besides, I know every inch of the skate low. I am not in any real danger. She sat down beside them, moving effortlessly to find a place between them, her gray and green robes settling about her like sea foam. You don't fly, do you, Kyber? No, but Pen does. He was born to airships. Her gaze shifted, not quite finding him. Don't tell my father. He doesn't like it when other flyers come aboard. He's very jealous of what's his. Pen thought, without having any better reason to do so than the way she said it, that she was including herself in that assessment. Too late, he told her. He found out from my uncle and already made a point of letting me know how lacking I am in real skills. Her smile dropped. I'm sorry, Pen. I would have warned you if I had known. Papa can be very hard. Is he hard on you? The smile returned, less certain. I am his most important crew member, she said, not quite answering the question. She hesitated. He wouldn't want me to tell you this, but I will anyway. I am his navigator. Pen and Kyber exchanged a quick glance. How do you manage that? The elven girl asked. I didn't think you could navigate if you couldn't see. The milky eyes shifted slightly toward the sound of Kyber's voice. I don't see with my eyes. I see with my other senses. She bit her lip. I can do things to help Papa that don't require sight. Again she paused. You mustn't tell Papa I told you any of this. He wouldn't like it. Why wouldn't he like it? Pen asked. Papa worries about outsiders, people other than rovers. He doesn't trust them. Nor do we trust him, Pen thought. Not a good situation. I still don't understand this navigation business, Kyber pressed, her brow furrowing. Tell us something more about how you help your father. Cinnaminson! All three turned in the direction of the voice. Gar Hatch had turned around in the pilot box and caught sight of them. He looked furious. Come help your papa, little girl, he ordered brusquely. You've sailor work to do. She stood up at once. Coming, Papa. She glanced down quickly. Say nothing, she whispered. She left without another word, walking straight to the pilot box and climbing in. Pen watched to see what would happen and wasn't sure if he was relieved or disappointed when nothing did. Gar Hatch put his hand on his daughter's shoulder, patted it briefly, and turned back to steering the vessel. Cinnaminson remained standing beside him. What do you make of that? He asked Kyber. A bad business that we should stay out of, she answered. She regarded him thoughtfully. I think we ought to cut your hair. That long red mane is too recognizable. Maybe we should dye it, too. She put down her riding tools and went off to find her scissors. They were told at the evening meal that after dark, passengers were not allowed topside until morning. It was a rule of long standing aboard the Skate Low and the captain's express order. The reason given was concern for safety. A fall at night from the ship's sleek decking would almost certainly result in death. It was better if everyone but the crew stayed below. R.N. Elicidal assured the rover that the order would be obeyed, and Pen went to bed with every intention of breaking it. He woke sometime after midnight and slipped from his bed on cat's paws, brushing absently at his newly shorn hair, grimacing at the roughness of its feel. Hardly anything was left of it. Kyber had done a thorough job. He glanced at Tagwin, who was snoring loudly in the berth above him. Clearly the dwarf would not wake. Aran and Kyber shared a cabin down the hall, so he was less concerned about them. He took several breaths to settle himself, then moved to the door. He stood there for a moment, listening, but heard nothing. When he stepped outside, the corridor was empty. Other than the creaking of the rigging and the soft rustle of the mainsail and the almost dead night air, everything was silent. He went down the corridor and up the stairway, stopping often to listen. Having done that sort of thing any number of times before, he was not particularly worried about getting caught, but he did not care to be embarrassed by Gar Hatch again. So he went slowly and cautiously, and when he reached the head of the stairs and found the hatchway open, he stopped yet again. Above, not far from where he stood, he heard voices. It took him only seconds to recognize whose they were.
Not fair that I never get to talk to anyone. I don't tell them anything about us, Papa. I just like hearing about their lives.
Their lives don't matter to us, girl, Gar Hatch responded firmly but not unkindly. They aren't of our people, and you won't see them again after this journey.
Then what does it matter if I talk to them?
It matters in ways you don't understand because you are still a child. You must listen to me. Be pleasant to them. Be helpful when it is needed, but do not go out of your way to speak to them. That is a direct order, sailor. There was silence after that. Pen remained standing where he was, listening. He wanted to peek outside, but he was afraid that if he did, he would be seen. The moon was 3/4 full and the sky clear. There was too much light to take a chance. He wondered what was going on up there that he wasn't supposed to see. As far as he could tell from what he was hearing, nothing at all.
I'm going below to sleep for a few hours, Hatch announced suddenly. You take the helm, Cinnaminson. Keep her on course, no deviations. There's no weather on the horizon, so the sail should be smooth enough. You know what to do. Come get me if there's trouble. Good girl. I'll come back before dawn.
Pen retreated down the steps as swiftly as he could manage, reached his cabin, and stepped inside. He stood with his back against the door and listened as Gar Hatch trudged past toward the captain's quarters. The rover's footsteps receded, a door opened and closed, and everything was silent again, save Tagwin snoring. For a moment, Pen determined to go topside again, but he was nervous about it now, afraid that Hatch might come back and catch him. What had he said? You take the helm, Cinnaminson? How could she do that, if she was blind? Was she up there all alone, steering the airship and charting their course when she couldn't see? That didn't seem possible, and yet... He stood a while longer, debating what to do. In the end, he went back to bed. Kyber was right. It was none of his business, and he shouldn't mix in it. Aran wouldn't like it if he jeopardized their safety through his interference. He couldn't afford to antagonize Hatch while they depended on him. Perhaps he thought he would just ask Cinnaminson the next time he saw her. If she would speak to him, that was. He went back to bed to think about it some more, and was asleep in moments. Chapter 17 They flew north out of the Westland, then turned east across the Strelaheim Plains, down the corridor that lay between the Dragon's Teeth and the Knife Edge Mountains. It was a shipping lane used by almost everyone traveling west and east above Callahorn, and they passed other airships at regular intervals. The weather remained good, the skies clear and calm, the days warm and dry, the nights deep and cool, and there were no more storms. The Skatelow kept a steady pace, but not a fast one, staying low and hugging the forest line above Perenor. She sailed at night as well as during the day, and Gar Hatch put her down only twice in 3 days for fresh water and brief repairs. Pen spoke with Cinnaminson every day, several times a day, and there was no indication from her behavior that she was trying to avoid him. In fact, she seemed eager to search him out, although she never did so in a way that suggested she was disobeying her father's wishes. Pen, for his part, tried to make their meetings seem to those who might observe to be about something other than their growing friendship. But he didn't even try to pretend to her that he wasn't interested. He was captivated, and even at his young age he could not mistake what he was feeling for her. He was excited just at the prospect of seeing her, and every day brought new opportunities to do so. He looked forward to those moments with an anticipation that made him ache. But he never asked her about that first night. The more he thought about doing so, the less comfortable he felt. In the first place, he had been spying on her, and he didn't want her to know that. Nor could he think of a way to broach the subject without seeming to pry. It wasn't his place to ask her what she was doing for her father. At best, it would make her uncomfortable because anything she told him would be a betrayal. He still wanted to know how she could sail an airship despite being blind, but he decided it would have to be her idea to tell him. He had plenty of time to indulge his newfound attraction for her. Tagwin was often airsick and seldom appeared topside. He was a dwarf, he pointed out sourly, and he belonged on the ground. Kyber had resumed her druid studies and spent most of her time with her uncle. Penn would see them sitting across from each other on the decking, heads bent close in conversation, the girl taking notes and making animated gestures that indicated she was trying to understand what he was teaching. Much of the time they remained in their cabin, freer to engage in open discussion than when the Rovers were present. Kyber, always intense, seemed more so now that they had set out, perhaps appreciating better than Penn did the weight of the task she had agreed to shoulder. But Penn, too, spent much of his time thinking about why he was there, a passenger aboard an airship bound for the charnels and country few had ever explored. He no longer questioned whether what he was doing was the right thing. He no longer even questioned the motives of the King of the Silver River in sending him. He just accepted it and concentrated instead on how he was going to get through in one piece. If he allowed himself to think about the larger picture, it was too overwhelming to contemplate. So much was expected of him, and he had no reason to believe those expectations were justified. He found he could manage better if he considered things incrementally. Step one was escaping the Gallifile and Terek Molt. He'd done that. Step two was reaching Emberin and enlisting help from Aran Elicidal. He'd done that, too. Step three was embarking on the journey east. When he got to step four, however, things became a little less clear. Finding the Tanaquil was the goal, but he had the feeling that there were a few other steps in between, and he would not find out what they were right away. Only time would reveal them, and it would not do to try to plan too far ahead. That he was making the journey on faith in the first place helped him accept that, but it didn't make him any less anxious about the outcome. Spending time with Cinnaminson relaxed him most. He understood it was an indulgence, one that was difficult to justify given the seriousness of his purpose. But he understood as well that something was needed to distract him from his doubts and fears, and turning his thoughts to Cinnaminson helped. He wasn't foolish enough to expect that this infatuation would grow into something more. He knew it would be finished when they reached their destination and disembarked from the airship. But it did no good to think in those terms. Better to allow a little light into a darkened room than to worry about what would happen once it faded. On the third day they were sitting in the bow where he was pretending to write and she to listen to what he had written, their backs to the pilot box and gar hatch. "Can you tell me where you are going?" she asked him quietly. "I can tell you anything, Cinnaminson." "Not anything. You know you can't do that." He nodded to himself. She understood some things better than he did. "We go into the charnels, looking for the ruins of an ancient city. Aran wants to look for something there." "But he brings you and Kyber and Tagwin to help him," she said. "An odd company for such an effort." Her fingers brushed his wrist, a soft swirl that made him itch all the way down to his toes. "I won't lie to you," he said finally. "There's more to this. I'm sworn to secrecy. Better that you tell me so than deceive me. I have traveled with enough passengers to know when they keep secrets. My father is paid to keep it so. But I want to know that you will be safe when you leave me. I want to know that I might see you again someday." His hand closed on hers and he stared into her milky, empty eyes. She did not see him, but he could feel her watching in other ways. He studied her face, the lines and curves and softness, the way the light fell against her skin. He loved to look at her. He could not have told anyone why, just that he did. "You will see me again," he said quietly. "Will you come find me?" she asked him. "I will. Even if I am flying somewhere on the Skatelow, you will look for me." He felt his throat tighten. "I don't think I could do otherwise," he said. "I think I have to." Then, without thinking about who might be watching, he leaned forward and kissed her on the mouth. She kissed him back without hesitation. It was a thrilling, tantalizing kiss, and he immediately wanted more. But he was playing a dangerous game, and contemplating the way it might end tempered his enthusiasm sufficiently that he kept himself in check. He broke away, not daring to look back at the pilot box. "Sorry," he said. "Don't be sorry," she answered at once, leaning into his shoulder, head lowered so that her hair brushed his bare arm. "I wanted you to do that. Your father won't like it. My father wasn't looking." Unable to help himself, he glanced over his shoulder. Gar Hatch was turned away, working on placing lines at the rear of the box. She was right. He hadn't seen anything. Penn looked back at her.
How did you know that?
She gave him a smile that reached all the way into his heart.
I just did, she said,
and kissed him again.
I wish you'd stop following Cinnaminson around like an eager puppy, Kyber told him late that same day while they were sitting together at the bow of the Skatelow.
She brushed back her thick dark hair and stared out at a sky lit purple and rose, her brow furrowed by deep lines of condemnation.
I like her, he said, as anyone can plainly see, including her father. Even Uncle Arryn has noticed, and he usually doesn't bother with such nonsense.
He frowned.
Nonsense? Well, it is. Do you have any idea what you're doing? You're going to get us in a lot of trouble if you aren't careful. You don't know everything.
I know what I see, what everyone sees. I don't think you've thought this through. Or if you have, you've managed to leave out the important parts. You know how her father feels about outsiders. He doesn't want anything to do with us beyond taking our money. Rovers live by a different code of behavior than the rest of us. Everyone knows that. So why do you persist in nosing around after Cinnaminson?
He looked sharply at her. Stop it, Kyber.
Stop what?
Stop telling you the truth?
You don't have to be so mean about it. Have you forgotten that my mother is a rover?
They glared at each other, each silently daring the other to say something more, each refusing to give ground. Penn knew Kyber was right about Cinnamons, and even if he wouldn't admit it, he knew he shouldn't be interested in her, even in a casual way, and certainly not in the way he was. But he didn't know what he could do about it. It wasn't as if he had chosen for it to happen. It just had. Now he was stuck with his feelings, and he couldn't cast them aside or bundle them up and stick them in a locker. He was way beyond that, and besides, he wasn't at all sure he wanted to change things anyway.
We're being careful, he said finally.
She snorted.
How, exactly? Are there things happening between the two of you that I'm not seeing?
I certainly hope not, because what I am seeing is already way too much.
He wheeled on her. Just because your brother wants to marry you off and you don't like the idea doesn't mean the rest of us have to feel the same way about things.
Oh, are you thinking of marrying her?
That's not what I mean.
He was furious now.
I mean I don't have to be as close-minded as you obviously are. I don't have to be like you.
Keep your voice down, she hissed.
Behind them, Gar Hatch stood in the pilot box. Penn shot him a quick look, but he didn't seem to notice the boy. His eyes were directed forward toward the horizon.
You're being unreasonable, Penn hissed back at her. We're just friends.
She started to reply, then stopped herself. Her face softened, her anger faded, and she nodded slowly.
All right, Penn. Let's drop the matter.
What right do I have to tell you how to behave anyway? Ask my family how well-behaved I've been. I haven't the right to lecture you. He sighed wearily, looking out over the bow toward the approaching night.
I know I shouldn't be doing this. I know I should just stay away from her. I know that.
Kyber put her hand on his shoulder and squeezed.
But you can't and you won't, and I don't have the right to ask you to do so. I wouldn't want you telling me what to do if our positions were reversed. But I worry anyway. I don't want you disappearing over the side of the ship one night just because you smiled at this girl once too often. Everything we're doing depends on you. We can't afford to lose you. Just keep that in mind when you're thinking about how pretty she looks.
He exhaled sharply.
You don't have to worry about that. I can't stop thinking about it. That's part of the reason I like being with her. She helps me forget for a little while.
They didn't say anything for a long time as they looked out at the skyline, listened to the cries of the seabirds and the hum of the ship's rigging. The western sky had gone shadowed and gray with the setting of the sun, and the first star had appeared in the north.
Just be careful, Kyber said finally.
He nodded, but did not answer. The fourth day of travel dawned gray and sullen with storm clouds layered all across the northwest horizon, roiling and windswept as they bore down on the Strelaheim. Penn came on deck at first light to find Gar Hatch and both Rover crewmen hard at work taking down the sails, tightening the rigging and lashing in place or carrying below everything that might be lost in the blow. Cinnaminson was standing in the pilot box, her face lifted as if to taste the raindrops that had begun to fall. He thought at first to go to her, then decided against it. There was no reason to do so, and it would call needless attention to his infatuation. Instead, familiar enough with what was needed to be able to help, he went to help the crewmen secure the vessel. They glanced at him doubtfully as he joined them in their work, but said nothing to discourage it. Behind him, Aran and Kyber appeared as well, standing in the hatchway, stopped by a wind that had begun to howl through the rigging like a banshee.
"Get below!" Gar Hatch bellowed at them. His gaze shifted to Penn. "Penderin, take Cinnaminson down with them, then come back on deck. We need your strong back and skilled hands, lad. This is a heavy blow we're facing down."
Penn dropped what he was doing and raced at once to the pilot's box, slipping precariously on decking slick with dampness. He heard Cinnaminson shouting at him as he reached her, but her words were lost in the shrieks and howls of the wind. Shouting back that everything would be all right, he took her arm and steered her out of the pilot box and over to the hatchway, bending his head against the sudden gusts that swept into him. Again she tried to say something, but he couldn't make it out. Aran was waiting to receive her, and Penn turned back at once to help the beleaguered rovers.
"Safety lines!" Gar Hatch roared from the pilot box, where he had taken over the controls.
Penn found one coiled about a clasp on the mainmast and snapped the harness in place around his waist. The Skaitlow was dropping swiftly toward the plains as Gar Hatch sought shelter. The rover captain had to set her down or she would be knocked out of the sky. But finding a place that would offer protection from the wind and rain was not so easy when it was impossible to see clearly for more than a dozen yards. The sails were down by then, so the boy hurried forward to secure the anchor ropes and hatch covers. Rain began to fall in sheets, a deluge that soaked Penn in only seconds. He had not worn his weather cloak on deck, and his pants and tunic offered no protection at all. He ignored the drenching, blinking away the torrent of water that spilled out of his hair and into his eyes, fighting to reach his objective. Still descending toward the plains, a stricken bird in search of a roost, the airship was shaking from the force of the wind. Penn had almost reached the bow when the other end of his safety harness whipped past him like a snake, shooting out through the railing and over the side. It took him a moment to realize what had happened, that it had somehow come free, and his hesitation cost him his footing as the snap of the line jerked him off his feet. He went down on his back, his hands grasping for something to hold on to as he began to slide toward the open railing, skidding on rain-slick decking, unable to stop himself. He had only a moment to wonder how the line had come loose before he was tumbling over the side. He would have fallen to his death if he had not caught hold of one of the stanchions, and even so, the effort of stopping himself nearly dislocated his arms. He hung helplessly over the side, legs dangling and arms stretched to the breaking point. For a second, he thought he would not be able to hold on. The airship was lurching and heaving as the wind whipped at it, and it felt as if everything was about to let go.
"Penderin!" he heard Gar Hatch scream.
He looked across the decking through the rain to where the rover captain stood braced in the pilot box with a coiled line gripped in both hands. Catching the boy's eye, he gave the line a heave that sent it flying all the way forward and across the railing, not 6 feet from where Penn hung suspended. Working the line with both hands, Gar Hatch whipsawed it back and forth across the railing until it fell over Penn's shoulder.
"Grab on!" the big man shouted.
The boy hesitated. There was no reason for his safety line to have come loose unless someone had released the locking pin. The man best in position to do that was the one offering to help him now. If he wanted Penn dead, all he had to do was wait for him to grab the line, then release it. Penn would be over the side and gone. Was that what Gar Hatch intended for him? Was he incensed enough about Cinnaminson to kill Penn? The airship shuddered violently, and Gar Hatch was thrown to one side in the box.
"Hurry, lad!" he cried out.
Penn released his grip on the stanchion one hand at a time and transferred his weight to the rope the big man had thrown him. As he hung from it, the line the only thing keeping him from tumbling away, he experienced a terrible certainty that he had made a mistake and was going to pay for it with his life. Then Gar Hatch began to haul on the rope, and Penn felt himself being lifted back over the side of the vessel and onto the deck. In seconds, he was back aboard and flat on his stomach as he crawled toward the pilot box, his heart still in his throat. Gar Hatch extended his hand over the side of the box and pulled him in effortlessly, dark eyes glittering.
There now, safe again. That was close, Penderin. What happened to your line? Did you check to see that it was secure at the masthead before buckling in?
Penn had to admit he had not. No, I didn't think there was any need.
Haste is a dangerous enemy aboard an airship, the rover captain declared, tucking his chin into his beard. You want to be careful how you go, especially in weather like this. Good thing I was watching out for you, lad.
His eyes narrowed.
Good thing, too, I decided you were worth the trouble of saving. Another man with another daughter might have thought otherwise. You want to remember that.
He gave Penn a none too gentle shove.
Down you go with the others till this is over. Better think on what I just said while you're there.
Penn made his way out of the pilot box and across the decking to the hatchway, a cold place opening in the pit of his stomach. Behind him, he heard the rover captain laugh.
Chapter 18.
Safety lines don't come loose for no reason at all, Kyber Elisidal whispered, poking him in the chest to emphasize her point. They don't get put away with one end left unattached, either. Outside, the wind hammered and the rain beat against the wooden hull of the Skatelow as if to collapse it to kindling.
I thought that too, Penn answered, shaking his head.
The cold feeling wouldn't leave him. It had found a home deep inside, and even being down in the companionway and out of the weather didn't ease its chill.
But I couldn't argue about it with him, because he was right. I hadn't checked it.
They were huddled together in his tiny cabin, talking in low voices and casting cautious looks at the closed door as they did so. Creaks and groans filled the silences, reminders of the precariousness of their situation. Overhead they heard the heavy boots of the rover crewmen as they moved about the decking, making sure the airship didn't break free of her moorings. They had landed only minutes ago in the lee of an oak grove at the edge of Perenor's forests, anchored about 5 feet off the ground while they rode out the storm. Gar Hatch had come below immediately and taken Cinnaminson to his cabin. Aran and Tagwin were in the druid's quarters already by then, the dwarf sicker than Penn had seen a man in some time. Kyber frowned.
It doesn't matter what he says anyway. The point is, we know how he feels.
I doubt that he cared all that much whether you went over the side or not. A fall would have been an unfortunate accident, but accidents happen. Carelessness on your part, he'd say, exactly what he warned you against earlier. He doesn't have to answer for your failure to listen, but saving you works even better. It lets him make clear to you how vulnerable you are. He's made his point. Now you know for sure not to come near his daughter anymore.
She paused. You do know that now, don't you? He sighed.
Stop trying to tell me what to do, Kyber.
Someone has to tell you. You don't seem capable of figuring things out on your own.
She scowled and went silent, and they both looked away, listening to the wind howl across the decking.
I'm just trying to keep you from getting killed, Penn.
I know.
What was Cinnaminson trying to tell you when you were bringing her down? Did you find out?
Just to be careful. To watch out for myself, that's all.
She knew.
She was trying to warn you. Kyber shook her head. I wish this trip was over. I wish we were rid of these people.
He nodded, thinking at the same time that he wished he were rid of everyone but Cinnaminson.
It didn't seem fair that a simple friendship should put him in so much danger. He still couldn't quite bring himself to believe it, although he had no illusions about what Gar Hatch might be capable of. Kyber was right about what happened topside. He might never know if Hatch intended for him to go over the side, but he knew for certain that he had been warned.
Well, the trip will be over soon enough, he muttered, suddenly bone-weary and heartsick. Probably nothing else will happen now anyway.
Kyber exhaled sharply.
I wouldn't bet on it.
Although he didn't say so, Penn guessed he wouldn't either.
The storm passed around midday, the winds dying down and the rain ending, and the Skatelow resumed her journey east. By then she was above the Janison Pass, leaving Paranor and Callahorn and sliding north along the foothills fronting the Charnels and the Eastland. The weather turned sultry and the skies were clouded over and gray for as far as the eye could see. Water birds soared overhead from the mountain lakes and rivers, white flashes against the gloom, their cries eerie and chilling. Far to the east and south, the departing storm clouds formed a dark wall splintered by flashes of lightning. Except for the still airsick Tagwin, everyone was back on deck by then, looking out at the distant mountains, catching the first glimpses of their destination. It was another day's journey to the Lazarene, but Penn felt a shift in his thinking anyway. His time with Cinnaminson was growing short, for after the Lazarene there was only another day's flying before they left the airship. He marveled that only yesterday it seemed as if they had all the time in the world, and now it seemed that they had almost none. Part of his attitude was fostered by what had happened earlier, but even that wouldn't have discouraged him entirely, had they had another week to spend together. But he could do nothing to prolong their journey's ending, could change nothing about parting from Cinnaminson. They flew up the corridor leading off the Strelaheim toward the Malg Swamp, a misty flat smudge across the landscape on their left, the terrain in dark counterpoint to the rolling green foothills on their right. Gar Hatch took the airship lower, trying to avoid the heavier mix of clouds and mist that layered the sky with a thick ceiling between swamp and mountains. As they neared the Malg, the water birds disappeared, replaced by swarms of insects that defied winds and airspeed to attack the ship's passengers in angry clouds. Gar Hatch swore loudly and took his vessel up until finally the insects dropped away. Penn spit dead gnats from his mouth and wiped them from his nostrils and eyes. Cinnaminson appeared next to him, moving over from the pilot box with unerring directional sense, never wavering in her passage. And he was reminded again of how, even blind, she seemed able to see what was going on around her. He was about to ask her what her father had said to her in his cabin, but before he could do so, he heard something in the cry of a heron that winged past so close it felt as if he could reach out and touch it. He looked at it sharply, hearing in its call a warning he could not mistake. Something had frightened the bird, and that did not happen easily with herons. He scanned the horizon, then saw the dark swarm of dots soaring out of a deep canyon cut into the rugged foothills. Birds, he thought at once. Big ones. Rocks or shrikes. But they didn't fly like birds. There was no wing movement, and their shapes were all wrong. They were airships. Captain, he shouted over to Gar Hatch and pointed. For a long second the big man just stared at the shapes, then he turned back with a dark look on his face. Cinnaminson, get below and stay there. Take the other young lady with you. Penderin, come into the pilot box. I'll need you. Without bothering to wait for a reply, Gar began shouting at the rover crewmen, both of whom jumped in response. Within moments they were hoisting every scrap of sail they could manage, a clear indication that whatever was coming, Gar Hatch intended to run from it. Cinnaminson was already descending through the hatchway, but Kyber was having none of it. I'm staying, she declared firmly. I can help. Go below, Aran Elicidal ordered her at once. The captain commands on this ship. If I need you, I'll call. Stay ready. Pen, let's find out what is happening. Be careful, Kyber mouthed silently to the boy as she disappeared from view. Together, Penn and the druid hurried over to the pilot box and climbed inside. Gar Hatch was setting the control levers, readying them for when the sails were all in place. He scowled at Penn and the druid as if they might be responsible. "Put on your safety lines," he ordered. "Check both ends of yours, young Penderin. We've no time for mistakes here." Penn held his tongue, doing as he was told, buckling himself into his harness and testing the links. Aran Elicidal did the same. "Sometimes I wonder if it's worth it, making these runs," Gar Hatch growled. He nodded toward the approaching dots. "Those are flits. Single-passenger airships. Bothersome little gnats. Quick and highly maneuverable. Gnome raiders use them, and that's who those boys likely are. They want to bring us down for whatever we've got aboard. They'll do it, too, if they get close enough. I wouldn't worry normally, but that storm took something out of the skate low.
She's faster than they are when she's working right, but she's down in her power about 3/4, and I haven't the time to do the work necessary to bring her back up again until we reach the Lazarene.
We can't outrun them, Aran asked.
Gar Hatch shook his head.
I don't think so. If we get far enough ahead of them, they might lose interest. If they know the ship, they might fall off. If not,
he shrugged.
Still, there's other ways.
He yelled at the crewmen to make certain they were ready, then shoved the thruster levers all the way forward. The Skaitlo shuddered with the sudden input of power from the radiant draws and shot ahead, lifting skyward at the same time. Hatch worked the controls with swiftness and precision, and Penn could see that he had been down that road before. Even so, the flits were getting closer, growing larger and beginning to take shape. Penn saw the gnomes who were crouched in their tiny frames, faces wizened and burnt by wind and sun. Gloved hands worked the levers that changed the direction of the single-mast sail, a billowing square that could be partially reefed or let out to change direction and thrust. At present, all sails were wind-filled, catching the light, powering the flits ahead at full speed. Penn could already see that the Skaitlo had no chance of outrunning them. The angle of attack and her injuries from the storm didn't allow for it. The flits would be on them in moments.
"Penderin, lad," Gar Hatch said almost calmly. "Do you think you know enough by now to take the helm and keep her running full out?"
The boy nodded at once.
"I think so." "She's yours, then," the rover said, stepping aside. "You look like you might have fought a battle or two in your time," he said to Aran. "How are you with rail slings?"
They went out of the pilot box, safety harnesses trailing after them, and worked their way across the deck to either side of the mainmast. A rover crewman joined each of them, and in teams they began to set up the rail slings, pulling the catapults out of storage bins and setting the pivot ends into slots cut into the deck. Ben had never seen a rail sling before, but he understood their function right away. Built like heavy crossbows, they sat on swivels that could be pointed in any direction over the railings. A hand winch cranked back a sling in which sat a missile the size of a fist. When the sling was released, the missile hurtled out into the void, hopefully striking something in the process. Hitting a moving target with one of those weapons while flying in an airship was virtually impossible, unless the target was huge, in which case no damage was likely to occur. But used against a swarm of targets like the flits, a rail sling might have some success. Miss one flit and you still had a chance at half a dozen more. The rail slings were barely in place and loaded when the first of the flits reached them. The flits by themselves were useless as weapons, too small and fragile to ram a larger vessel or to shear off a mast. The gnomes' intent was to sever the radiant draws or rigging or to shred the ambient light sheaths. They did this by using poles with razor-sharp blades bound about the business end. In seconds, the flits were everywhere, coming at the Skaitlo from every direction. Penn kept the airship steady and straight, knowing that this offered Gar Hatch and R.N. Elicidal their best chance at bringing down their attackers. The rail slings were firing by then, and a few of the tiny ships went down, sails holed or masts shattered, plummeting earthward like stricken birds. One either miscalculated or failed for some other reason and crashed into the Skaitlo's hull, shattering on impact. Another became tangled in the bigger ship's rigging and crashed to the deck, where its pilot was seized by one of the rovers and thrown overboard. But the flits were inflicting damage on the Skaitlo as well. Several of her rigging lines had already been severed, and one radiant draw was frayed almost to the breaking point. The mainsail had a dozen rents in the canvas, and the flit that had become tangled in the rigging had brought down several spars. The Skaitlo was still flying, but Penn felt the unevenness of her effort. When the frayed draw finally snapped, he switched off power to the crystal it fed and transferred what remained to the others. But the airship was shaking and bucking and no longer responded smoothly.
"Hold her steady," Gar Hatch bellowed angrily.
Another flit whipped past Penn, the pole and blade sweeping down at his head, and he barely managed to duck away from it. Sensing the ship was in trouble and its crew unable to do any more to help her or themselves, the raiders were growing bolder. One good strike on one more essential component, and the vessel would not be able to stay in the air. She would fail quickly, and then she would be theirs. They were deep into Northland country by that time, flying close to the Malg, and mist had closed about them in a heavy curtain that reduced their vision to almost nothing.
The flit attacks seemed to materialize from nowhere as they winged out of the haze and then disappeared back into it again. How the gnome pilots could find their way under such conditions was beyond Penn. He was struggling to see anything. "Take her up," Hatch shouted at him. He did so, lifting her nose into the soup just as a gnome raider came right across the bow. The flit simply disintegrated, but pieces of it ricocheted everywhere, severing lines forward and starboard and cutting loose the flying jib. The Skatelow slewed sideways in response, and Penn could no longer make her do anything. Gar Hatch abandoned his rail sling and clawed his way back across the deck to regain the controls. In the midst of that chaos, with the Skatelow beginning to fall and the flits attacking like hornets, Aran Elicital stepped away from his rail sling, stood at the center of the airship's deck, and raised his arms skyward, his robes billowing like dark sails. For a moment he stood without moving, a statue at rest, eyes closed, head lifted. His face was calm and relaxed, as if he had found peace within himself and left the madness behind. Then his hands began to weave like snakes, and his voice to chant, the sound low and guttural and unrecognizable as his. Gar Hatch had hauled himself into the pilot box and taken over the controls from Penn with an angry grunt. His hands were flying over the levers and wheels, but when he looked up long enough to catch sight of Aran Elicital, he froze. "What in the name of sea, salt, and common sense is the man doing?" he demanded. The boy shook his head. He knew. "Saving us," he answered. Behind them, Kyber had come out on deck, grasping the hatchway frame to hold herself steady, and was shouting at her uncle in disbelief. Gnome raiders, bladed poles lowered to skewer him, were darting at the druid from all directions. But try as they might, they could not get close enough to do so. Mist obscured their vision, and gusts of wind knocked them aside, the mix roiling faster and faster, taking on the shape of a massive funnel. Heads began to turn in response. Aboard the Skatelow, the rovers were shouting. Astride the flits, there wasn't the time or energy to spare for it. The mist and wind had become a deadly whirlpool surrounding the airships and then closing on them. Aran Elicital's arms were stretched above his head as if he sought to grasp something that was just out of reach. The funnel cloud of mist and wind continued to tighten. It caught the outermost flits and engulfed them. One minute they were there, fighting to stay aloft, and the next they were gone. The rest tried to flee, banking their tiny ships in all directions, seeking a means of escape. Some came right at the Skatelow and Aran Elicital, but they could not get close enough to strike it either. One by one they were plucked from the sky by the funnel. One by one they disappeared until all were gone. The druid lowered his arms, the mist dissipated, the winds died, and the whirlwind vanished as well. Not a flit remained in the sky. Everything was the way it had been before the attack, the air hazy and gray but calm. The Skatelow sailed on, wounded but able to continue. In the distance, a sliver of sunlight broke through the clouds. Aran Elicital walked back over to the pilot box and beckoned to Penn. "Let's help clear the decks and put away the rail slings," he said. He glanced at Gar Hatch. "Odd weather we're having, isn't it? No one would ever believe such strange things could happen. A man would be crazy, even to suggest it." Penn smiled inwardly. The druid knew something about giving warnings as well, which was a good thing, he supposed, since now everyone aboard knew what he was. Chapter 19. Late in the morning of the following day, they arrived at Anachery, the inland port on the Lazarene that serviced all traffic passing north along the corridor formed by the Charnel Mountains to the east and the Knife Edge Mountains to the west. They reached their destination more quickly than anticipated because tailwinds filled and sunshine fed the sails, and because Gar Hatch had been able to complete repairs to the damaged radiant draw before nightfall of the previous day. It was a smooth flight the entire way after their escape from the flits, with no further trouble arising to impede their passage. Anachere was an old city built by a mix of trolls and bordermen following the Second War of the Races, when Southlanders were mostly keeping to themselves below Callahorn, but trade was flourishing everywhere else. A sprawling, ramshackle outpost in its early days, it grew quickly, the principal port servicing trappers and traders coming out of the Anar, Callahorn, and everywhere the Troll nations made their homes. It had become a major city, though still with the look and feel of a frontier town, its buildings spread out along the southwest shore of the lake, timber and shingle structures that were torn down and replaced as the need arose, and without much thought to permanency. Even though the greater part of the populace lived in the city, most did not intend to make Anachre their final stop along life's road, and so did not build for the long term. The Skatelar sat down at the waterfront docks, where warehouses and barns loomed like low, squat beasts bent down for a drink at the Lazarine's dark waters, their mouths open to receive what the lake would deliver. Airships crowded the waterfront, most of them large freighters and warships. Traffic leaving the docks passed down roads flanked by alehouses, pleasure dens, and inns of various descriptions. Shops and homes lay farther inland, away from the bustle and din of the docks, back from the raw edge of seaport life. Standing on deck while the harbormaster towed the Skatelow to her assigned slip, Penn took a moment to glance over his shoulder in the other direction, back across the lake. The Lazarine was legendary. A broad, slate-gray body of water that seldom changed color in any weather, it was believed to run several thousand feet deep. Rumor had it that in some places it reached all the way to the netherworld and thereby provided the souls of the dead a doorway to the domain of the living. Mountains framed its rugged banks to the east and south, walls of stone that kept those souls contained. Dozens of rivers had their origins in snow-melt glaciers thousands of feet higher up, the confluence of their waters tumbling through canyons and defiles to feed the lake. Cold winds blew down out of snowy heights to mix with the warmer air of the flats and create a swirling mist that clung to the shorelines like gray moss. Penn did not like the Lazarine, he decided. It had the look and feel of the mist marsh, a place the boy was all too familiar with and wished never to visit again. The Skatelow eased up against the dock, and the rovers set about securing her. When Gar Hatch came over to speak with Arryn, Penn listened in. "I'll be needing several days to make repairs before we continue on," the rover captain advised in a gruff voice, hitching up his pants to emphasize that work lay ahead. "Maybe more. Once that's done, we'll continue on to where you need to go, and then I'll be dropping you off and saying goodbye."
"I don't think we discussed being dropped, Captain," the druid said, frowning. "I think the agreement was that you would wait until we came out again from our search."
"That was then, this is now. The agreement has changed." Gar Hatch spit over the side. "Others need a little business done as well and rely on me to conduct it for them. I require my ship to do so. I can't make a living while she sits idle. You don't pay enough for that. Give me a time and a place, and I'll come back for you. My captain's word on it."
"There isn't any way of knowing when we'll be finished. We can increase your purse if it's a matter of money."
The rover shook his head. "Sorry, mate. This isn't about money."
R.N. Elicital smiled. "You are a rover, Gar Hatch. It's always about money." The big man laughed and glanced over at Penn.
"You're listening close, young Penderin. Here's a man who knows the way of the world. He's right, too. Everything is about money, one way or the other."
He looked back at the druid. "Still, I can't let myself be tied down for so long. You might not even come back from wherever it is you're going. I've seen already the sort of business you do, and it isn't reassuring to puzzle on. So I'm dropping you, and that's the end of it."
The druid nodded. "I could find other passage and cancel our agreement here and now, Captain Hatch. I would be justified."
"You could try," the big man amended, "but you won't find anyone else to take you where you want to go that knows the ways of that country like I do. You won't find anyone who can sail the mists in the night like I can. Maybe most important of all, you won't find anyone who can keep his mouth shut about who you are and what you're doing. You might want to bear that in mind."
"But can I trust you? I find I have serious doubts."
Gar Hatch smiled and inclined his head.
"Put aside your doubts, sir. My word is good."
The irony of that statement probably did not escape the druid, but he let it pass.
3 days, Captain. That's as long as I'll give you to do your business here. We leave on the 4th. We'll find lodgings ashore and check back with you. I won't press for you to wait on us if you've decided against it, but there will be no further changes to our agreement, and I expect a close watch on the tongues of your people. Don't disappoint me. He went down the hatchway to his cabin to bring up Tagwin. Kyber was already on the dock, looking around eagerly. Penn sensed Gar Hatch staring at him and met his stare, refusing to look away when it lingered too long. The big man laughed.
"You've been a revelation for me, Penderin. A treasure and a find."
"Can I say goodbye to Cinnaminson?" Penn asked. He hadn't seen her since the attack of the Flitz. Gar Hatch had kept her shut away in his cabin, not even allowing her to come on deck at night, advising his passengers that she was ill. Penn had thought several times to sneak down and see for himself, but each time he thought to try, Gar Hatch was somewhere close, watching. It was his last chance until they reboarded in 3 days' time, and anything could happen between now and then. Hatch could promise what he wished, but that didn't mean it was likely to happen. The rover captain smiled.
"Better you don't, lad. What she's got might be catching. Wouldn't do to have you come down with a fever while you're resting in port. Your uncle is mad enough at me already. You'll see her when you come back aboard."
I'll never see her again, Penn thought. But he could do nothing about it short of forcing a confrontation, and he was aware how much trouble that would cause. He turned away without a word, shouldered his pack, and started down the ladder. He was halfway to the pier when he heard his name called.
"Penn, wait!"
Cinnaminson appeared at the railing, blind eyes staring downward without finding him. He started back up the ladder and stopped when he was close enough to see Gar Hatch glaring at him in the background.
"I'm feeling better now, Penn," she said, giving him a small wave and a smaller smile. "I just wanted to say goodbye."
Then she whispered so softly that only he could hear, "Come back tonight." She turned away quickly and went to her father, who took her by the arm and steered her below again, not bothering with even a glance at Penn. The boy stood watching until they were out of sight, then went down the ladder with his heart in his throat.
With Aran Elicidal leading, the four companions walked down through the center of the city, mingling with the crowds as they searched for a likely place to secure lodging for the days ahead. Penn could barely make himself concentrate on the task at hand, his mind still on Cinnaminson and her whispered words, "Come back tonight." He was intoxicated by them, made light-headed at the prospect of what they meant, chilled by the prospect of the danger at which they hinted. He wasn't afraid, though. He was fearless when it came to her. He understood that by even considering a secret return, he was risking not only his own safety, but also the success of his undertaking. Yet he couldn't help himself. He had to go to her. It took them the better part of an hour to find what Aran was looking for, a small, prosperous inn just off one of the main roadways, one that was better kept than those closer to the docks, one frequented by other travelers than sailors. It was called Fisherman's Lie. It sat on a corner that opened onto a small plaza and was wrapped by a veranda that fronted both streets. Broad double doors opened into the common room where travelers sat to visit and drink glasses of ale. Tables and benches and a long serving bar took up most of the available space. Flowers grew in boxes under the window sills, and baskets hung from the veranda and eaves, splashes of color to brighten the clabbered facade. Aran left the other three on the porch while he went inside to take rooms. The less they were all seen together, the less likely it was that anyone would make the connection to the four the druids were hunting. Since Kyber had cut Penn's hair short and bound his head in a scarf, none of them was particularly noticeable. But there was no point in taking chances. Those tempted by the money the druids offered would be looking hard. The elf emerged in moments with the room secured. They went into the dining room after that and sat at a table in the back while waiting for their food. Sipping at glasses of cold ale, they talked about their situation. "Hatch knows who I am," Aran said quietly, eyes scanning the mostly empty room as he spoke. "Or at least he knows what I am. He might not know my name yet, but there is a good chance he will find out. Or if not him, then one of the crewmen. All of them will be asking around, talking with other rovers.
Maybe not, Pen offered hopefully. You might have scared him out of it.
RN smiled. Not likely. Not that man. If he finds out who we are, he will look for a way to turn it to his advantage. It's his nature. So we have to be very careful until we set sail again. That's why I didn't tell him where he could find us. He mustn't know. If he betrays us, our enemies will still have to search us out. That won't be easy in a city of this size.
We should just leave him right here and now and be done with it, Tagwin snapped. He scowled into his glass. Take him up on his offer. That way we can stop worrying about him.
But not about getting to where we have to go, Aaron replied. I don't trust him either, but he is right when he says we will have trouble finding anyone else to fly us into the charnels. Even by looking, we risk giving ourselves away. Say what you want about Hatch, he knows how to sail. His reputation is one of getting in and out of tight places. We need that. I think we have to stick with him.
One of us could watch the Scalo and see who comes and goes, Kyber suggested. Her uncle shook his head.
That's too risky and too time-consuming. Besides, any one of them could give us away. We can't watch them all. Better to keep our heads down and wait this out. I will speak with Hatch each day to see how matters stand. If he lies to me, I will know. The rest of you will remain here, inside, out of sight. No one leaves the inn without permission until it is time to sail. Agreed? All of them nodded, but Penn knew it was an agreement he was going to break. He waited until it was dark and Tagwin was asleep before slipping out of his bed. He crossed the room in his bare feet, boots in hand, and went through the door without a sound. Instead of leaving by the inn's front entrance, he went out the back, taking the rear stairs to the street. Cloaked and hooded, he went quickly toward the waterfront. The night air was clear and sharp, turned cold after sunset, and the sky was bright with stars. It was close to midnight, but the streets were still bustling with activity, the denizens of the alehouses and pleasure dens just beginning their night's fun. Many were sailors, come from all over, a mix of travelers passing through. None of them looked at him. None spoke. He was taking a chance, risking everything. He was neither happy nor sad about it, felt neither guilt nor satisfaction. Such things didn't matter to a boy who thought he was in love. What mattered was that Cinnaminson was waiting, and the thought of her drove every other consideration from his mind. His excitement gave him courage and determination. It gave him a sense of invulnerability. Whatever happened, he was a match for it. His certainty was so complete that he never stopped to question whether his bravado might be playing him false. On that night, there was no place in his heart for rational thinking. He reached the waterfront and began working his way down the docks. New ships had arrived, some of them bigger than anything he had ever seen. He looked closely for the Gallifile as he went, but did not see her. Nor did he see Terek Molt or any other druids. Loading and unloading went on about him, unceasing, unending, and all seemed as it should. When he reached the Skatelo, he moved into the shadows across from her, staying well back from the light. There was no sign of life aboard. Even the storm lamps were extinguished. The boarding ladder was pulled up, signaling that visitors were unwelcome. On the piers to either side, similarly darkened ships lay at rest, sleeping birds awaiting the dawn. Penn eased along the wall of the warehouse that fronted the slip, then moved just to the edge of the light that pooled down from the lamps hung over the entrance doors. He stood there, undecided, searching the contours of the Skatelo for signs of life. Then he saw her. She appeared all at once, beckoning to him, knowing somehow that he was there. He took a chance, his throat tightening with anticipation. He stepped into the light, crossed the dock to the mooring slip, and stopped just below where she stood.
Cinnaminson, he said.
Her blind gaze shifted and her hair shimmered in the moonlight.
Wait, she whispered.
She moved at once to the ladder and dropped it over the side.
Come up. They're all in town at the alehouses and won't be back before dawn. We're alone.
He did, as she said, climbing the ladder and hauling himself aboard. He stood on the decking in front of her and she reached to take his hands.
I knew you would come, she said.
I couldn't stay away. She released his hands and pulled the ladder back aboard.
Sit with me over here, out of the light.
If they come, they need me to lower the ladder to let them aboard.
By then, you can be over the side.
She led him to the far side of the pilot box where the shadows were deepest, and they sat down with their shoulders touching and their backs to the low wall. Her milky eyes turned to find him.
Let's not tell each other any lies tonight, she whispered. Let's tell each other only truths.
He nodded.
All right. Who goes first?
I do.
It was my idea.
She leaned close.
Papa knows who you are, Penderyn Ormsford. He knew Arryn Elicidal was a druid after what happened during the flit attack, and he found out the rest from asking around the docks. He didn't give you away or let on that you were passengers on the Skatelow, but he knows.
Her smooth features were tight with trepidation and uncertainty, her chin lifted as if to take a blow. Pen touched her cheek.
Arryn told us this might happen. It isn't unexpected, but he had to reveal himself if he was to save us. Papa knows this, and he doesn't forget such favors. I don't think he intends you harm,
but I don't always understand how he thinks, either. She took his hands again.
Will you tell me where you are staying, so that if I discover you are in danger, I can warn you?
He hesitated. It was the one thing he had been ordered not to reveal, no matter what. He had promised to keep it a secret, and now Cinnaminson was asking him to violate his trust. It was a terrible moment, and his decision was made impulsively.
We are lodged at Fisherman's Lie, about half a mile into the city.
He squeezed her fingers.
But how will you find us, even if you need to? You'll have to ask for help, and that's too dangerous.
She smiled.
Let me tell you another truth, Penderyn. I can find you any time I want, because even though I am blind, I can see with my mind. I have always been able to do so. It is the way I was born, with a different kind of sight. I travel with Papa because I can see better than he can in darkness and in mist and fog, bad weather, storms of all sorts. I can navigate by seeing with my mind what is hidden to his eyes. That's why he can go into places others cannot, across the Lazarene, into the slags, places cloaked by weather and gloom. It's like a picture that appears behind my eyes of everything around me. It doesn't work so well in daylight, although I can see well enough to find my way about. But at night, it is clear and sharp. Papa didn't know I could do this at first. When Mama died, he began taking me to sea rather than leaving me with her relatives. He never liked them, or they him. Having me travel with him was less trouble than finding someone he trusted to raise me at home. I was still very young. I thought I was being given a chance to prove I was worth keeping. I wanted him to love me so that he wouldn't give me up. So I showed him how I could read the sky when no one else could. He understood my gift, and he began using me to navigate. I let him do so because it made me feel secure. I was useful, and so I believed he would keep me.
She paused.
Papa doesn't want anyone to know this. Only the two men who serve as crew know, and they are his cousins. Both are sworn to secrecy. He is protective of me. I am his daughter and helpmeet, but I am also his good luck charm. Sometimes he isn't clear on the difference. I think he loves me, but he doesn't know what loving someone really means.
She reached out and cupped his face in her hands.
There, I've given you a gift, a truth no one else has ever heard.
He took her hands in his own and squeezed them gently.
You've kept this to yourself a long time. Why are you telling someone now after so long? Why disobey your father's wishes like that? I wouldn't have minded if you had kept it secret.
She freed her hands and her fingers brushed at her hair and face like tiny wings.
I am tired of not being able to talk about it with anyone. Not talking about it is like pretending I am someone other than who I really am. I've been looking for someone to tell this to. I chose you because I think we are the same. We are both keeping secrets.
I guess that's so, he said. He sat back against the pilot box wall. Now it's my turn to tell you a secret. I hardly know where to begin, I have so many. You know who I am, but you don't know what I am doing here.
I can guess, she said. The Ardoris is your aunt. You are here because of her. But the druids say you are in danger.
They say that what happened to her might happen to you if you are not found and brought to them. Is that true?
He shook his head. I'm in danger, but mostly from them. Some of them are responsible for what's happened to her. If they find me, I might end up the same way. I escaped them when they came looking for me in Patch Run. So now I'm running away.
Are you looking for your parents?
I'm looking for my aunt. It's complicated. He paused. We promised to tell each other truths tonight, so let me tell you one. You have a kind of magic that no one else has.
So do I.
Like you, I was born with it. It is probably a part of the magic my father inherited, something that's been passed down through the Ohmsford bloodline for generations. Only, mine is different. He exhaled softly, searching for a way to explain. I can tell what plants and animals are feeling and sometimes thinking. They don't talk to me exactly, but they communicate anyway. They tell me things with their sounds and movements. For instance, I know if they're afraid or angry and what causes them to be so.
Your gift is not so different from my own, she said. You can see things that are hidden from other people, and you can see them without using your eyes. We are alike, aren't we?
He leaned forward. Except that I am free and you are not.
Why is that, Cinnaminson?
Could you leave your father if you wanted? Could you go somewhere else and have a different life? It was such an impulsive question that he surprised himself by asking it. Worse, he had nothing beyond encouragement to offer if she answered yes. What could he do to help her in his present circumstances? He couldn't take her with him, not where he was going. He couldn't offer to aid her while Arryn was so determined not to aggravate Gar Hatch. She laughed softly.
Such a bold question, Pendaren.
What should I do?
Leave my papa and run away with you?
A blind girl and a fugitive boy?
I guess it sounds silly, he admitted. I shouldn't have asked.
Why not? She pressed, surprising him.
Do you care for me?
You don't have to ask that.
Then you must care about me, too. So it seems right to want an answer.
I like it that you do.
Yes, I want a different life. I have looked for it. But you are the first to whom I have talked about it. You are the first to ask.
He stared at her face, at her smooth features, at the smile that curved her lips, at her strange blank eyes. What he felt for her in that instant transcended love. He might say that he loved her, but he didn't know all that much about love, so saying it wouldn't mean anything. It was only a word to him. He was still only a boy. But this other feeling, the one that was more than love, encompassed whole worlds. It whispered of connection and sharing, of confidences and truths like the ones they had told each other tonight. It promised small moments that would never be forgotten and larger ones that could change lives. What could he give her that would tell her this? He struggled to find an answer, lost in a sea of confusing emotions. Her hands were holding his again, her fingers making small circles against his skin. She wasn't saying anything. She was waiting for him to speak first.
If you were to decide you wanted to leave your father, I would help you, he said finally. If you wanted to come away with me, I would let you. I don't know how that could happen. I only know that I would find a way.
She lowered her head just enough that the shadows grazed her face and hid her expression.
Would you come for me, wherever I was, Pen? It is a bold thing to ask, but I'm asking it anyway. Would you come for me?
Wherever you are, whenever you have need, he whispered. She smiled, her face lifting back into the light.
That is all I need to know.
She sat back and turned her face to the starlit sky.
Enough of making promises and telling truths. Let's just sit together for a little while and listen to the night.
They did so, side by side, not saying anything, their hands in their laps, their shoulders and hips touching. The sounds of the waterfront rolled over them in small bursts and slow meanderings, brief intrusions from a place that seemed far away. The night turned colder, and Penn wrapped them both in his cloak, putting his arm around her to lend his warmth, feeling her small form melt against him. After a time, she leaned over and kissed him on the cheek.
You must leave now. It grows late. They will return. Go back to your room and sleep.
She kissed him again.
Come again tomorrow if you can. I will be waiting.
He rose and walked with her to the ladder, scanning the dock for signs of approaching rovers. The docks were empty now. She lowered the ladder for him and he climbed down. He stood looking up at her as she pulled it away again. Then he turned and went down the waterfront.
Cinnaminson.
Nothing in his life, he knew, would ever be the same again. Chapter 20 Grian Omsford woke to a morning so dismal and gray that it might have drifted out of the marshy depths of the Malg Swamp, an apparition come in search of the unfortunate Jarkarus. It felt alive and hungry. It had a shape and feel. The air it breathed smelled of fetid water and brushed at the skin with greasy, insistent fingers. The clouds that formed its hair were so low in the sky as to be indistinguishable from the misty beard that curled about its ragged face. Everything about it whispered of hidden danger and lost souls. In its presence, heartbeats quickened with the uneasy and certain knowledge that death, when it appeared, would be quick and unexpected. The Ardreis was cramped from sleeping in the cradle of tree limbs, her body aching and stiff. She had slept, though she did not pretend to understand how, and she had kept her perch and not fallen as she had feared she would. Climbing down through broom that would have discouraged even the most intrepid seabird, she caught sight of the tracks that crisscrossed the earth directly below and decided she had been lucky to have survived the night with no more than her sore muscles. Weka Dart had been right to warn her against trying to make her bed on the ground. She glanced around, scanning the mist and gloom for some sign of the devious little Ulk Bog, thinking he might have come back during the night, even as mad at her as he had been when he left. After all, he had gone to a lot of trouble to persuade her to allow him to accompany her, and she found it hard to believe that he would toss it all away because of a perceived slight. He didn't seem the type who would allow insults to get in the way of ambitions. She still wasn't sure what he was after, only that he was after something. But there was no sign of him, so she accepted that he had gone his own way after all. Just as well, she told herself. Except that she didn't know the country, and that put her at a disadvantage. She knew in general how she should go, given that the Forbidding mirrored the four lands. She could estimate the location of the Hadeshorn from what she knew of its location in her own world. But the mist was confusing, and her sense of direction skewed by the different land formations. Worse, she would have to risk encountering the monsters that inhabited the Forbidding, without knowing who and what they were. At least Weka Dart had knowledge of the things she needed to avoid. But there was no help for it, nor help for her lack of food and water. She would have to forage for both as she traveled, hoping that she would recognize the former when she saw it. Water should be less of a problem, although just then she didn't want to assume anything. She stretched her aching limbs and looked down at herself. Ragged and dirty, she was a mess. Her clothes were almost in shreds, her pale skin showing through the gaps in ways that didn't please her. She wrapped her tattered nightdress closer and told herself she would have to find something else to wear soon, or she would be naked as well as starving and lost. She couldn't travel much farther without boots, either. Her feet were already scraped and bleeding, and she hadn't even gotten to the rocky climb to the Hadeshorn.
When I find out who did this to me...
She was about to set out when there was movement in the trees to one side, and Weka Dart, bristle-haired and spindly-limbed, emerged carrying a cloth-wrapped package in both arms. He caught sight of her and stopped, his sharp teeth showing as he smiled broadly.
Ah, Grian of the trees. Sleep well, did you?
You don't look so bad for having spent the night above ground. See all the tracks? He gestured.
Now you understand what I was telling you.
She stared at him without answering, undecided if she was happy about having him back. His cunning features scrunched with disappointment.
Don't look at me like that. You should be pleased to see me. How far would you get without me? You don't know anything about this part of the world. Anyone can tell that. You need me to guide you.
I thought you were finished with me, she said. He shrugged.
I changed my mind.
I decided to forgive you. After all, you have a right to know about me, so you did what Strakens do and used your magic to find out. It isn't any different than what any creature of habit would do. Here, I brought you some clothes. He came forward and dumped the bundle at her feet. She bent down and picked through it, finding leather boots, a loose-fitting cotton shirt, pants, a belt and knife, and the great cloak in which he had wrapped them. All were in good condition and close enough in size to fit her comfortably. She had no idea where he had found them and didn't think she should ask. "Put them on," he urged. "Turn your back," she replied. It was silly, given that an Ulkbog would not be interested about her that way, but she wanted to assert her authority before he got the wrong idea about who was in charge. If he was going to accompany her on the rest of her journey, as it appeared he was determined to do, she had better set him straight on the nature of their relationship immediately. She removed the nightdress and put on the clothes, watching him fidget as he stared off into the trees. "I want to know why you insist on coming with me," she told him. "And don't tell me it's because you want to help a stranger find her way." He threw up his hands. "Can't anyone do a good turn for you without being questioned about it?" "In your case, no. You don't seem the type to do good turns unless there is something in it for you. So let's be honest about it. What is it that you want from me? Maybe it isn't anything I'll mind giving up, if it means you can get me to where I want to go." She finished buttoning the tunic. "You can turn around now." He did so, looking sour-faced and ill-used. "I thought Strakens could tell what normal people are thinking. Why don't you just use your magic to find out what I want?" She didn't bother with an answer, waiting patiently on him. He pouted. "You already know the reason. You just weren't paying attention when I told you. Too self-absorbed, I suspect." "Tell me again." He pouted harder. "I got in some trouble with my tribe. I had to flee for my life. They might still be chasing me. Alone, I'm not much good against a lot of the things that are Jarkat Rus. I know how to find my way and mostly how to avoid them, though. So I thought we could help each other." He folded his arms defiantly. "There. Are you satisfied, Grianne of the curious mind and endless questions?" He was being insolent, but she let it go. "I am, for now. But in the future you will tell me the truth about your motives and your plans, little rodent, or I will feed you to the bigger things you seek to avoid. I don't like surprises. I want to know what you were thinking about. No secret plans, or our bargain is off." "Then you agree that we should travel together?" he asked. He was positively gleeful. "That you will watch out for me?" He caught himself. "Well, that we will watch out for each other." "Let's just start walking," she said, and turned away. They walked all that day, traveling east below the dragon line and across the grasslands and foothills of the Passionon. The weather stayed gray and misty, the sun never more than a faint brightness high above them, the world they journeyed through composed of broom and shadows. The air was damp and chilly, a discomforting presence that made Grianne grateful for the clothes and boots that Weka Dart had brought her. The grasslands and hills were coated with moisture that never quite evaporated, yet the land remained barren and lifeless. The absence of small birds and little animals was unnerving, and even the insects tended to be of the buzzing, biting variety. Grasses grew thick and hardy, sawtooth and razor blade spears that were a washed-out green and mottled gray. Trees were stunted and gnarled below the dragon line, and many were little more than skeletons. The waters of the ponds and streams were stagnant and algae-laced. Everywhere they traveled and everywhere she looked, the world seemed to be sick and dying. Yet the Jarkat Rus had existed for thousands of years. She tried to imagine a lifetime in such a world and failed. It frightened her to think of being trapped there for long. If she had not believed that she would find a way out, she would have been devastated. But she never wavered in her certainty that she would. Those who had sent her there had made a mistake in letting her live. They might think themselves rid of her, but she would prove them wrong. Her thoughts drifted frequently to the cause of her predicament.
It was impossible for her to know exactly who had transported her, but she could make an educated guess or two. What baffled her was why they hadn't simply killed her and been done with it. It was what she would have done to them when she was the Ill's witch. Leaving a dangerous enemy alive to come looking for you later, no matter how difficult the task, was always risky. So why had they let her live? It would have been no more difficult for them to kill her than to send her into the Forbidding. It made her think something else was happening, a reason for her enemies to keep her alive and imprisoned. It also made her ponder anew the source of the power it had taken to put her here. It was more than even the most powerful of the druids possessed. It was beyond anything that existed in her world. It was a power, she was beginning to think, that might have come from the Forbidding itself. Her ruminations kept her occupied for much of her journey. Weka Dark continued to skitter about, dodging sideways and occasionally climbing up and down trees and rock formations, but always moving. He did not talk much, for which she was grateful, absorbed apparently in keeping an eye out for the things they should avoid. There were a great number of those, and they encountered many of them on their way. Ogres and giants stomped through the grasslands, mindless behemoths, dim-sighted and single-minded, with great shoulders hunched and massive arms dragging. Harpies flew overhead, winged shrews that screamed and spit venom at each other and anything below. A scattering of dragons came and went, smaller for the most part and different from the drachas. Various forms of fairy creatures were glimpsed as well, particularly kobolds, which seemed to live in large numbers in that region. Once they saw a village of gormies far in the distance, a mud and grass huddle of shelters cut like caves into a hillside. Walls fronted the village and spikes jutted out of the earth in pointed warning. The gormies themselves, ferret-eyed and wiry, crept about their enclosure like shades. What would frighten an entire village of those little terrors? She asked Weka Dart. He laughed and growled deep in his throat. Wait and see. She did so, and a few hours later she had her answer. They had just crested a small rise, catching sight of a valley that stretched away to the east, when Weka Dart wheeled around suddenly, hissing, "Down, down!" She dropped at once, flattening herself against the earth, pressing into tufts of the spiky grass that grew everywhere. Her breathing turned sharp and quick.